Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to call the meeting to order. We don't have a quorum yet, but we will begin our meeting. To all the guests, welcome today. Our first agenda of business. Oh, thank you. I thought we only do that when we have a quorum.
We will.
Okay. Is to call DHS down to testify. So I'd like to ask Alex Bartolik and Gene Wood to come down at this time. Oh, I'm sorry. We're going to first do the governor's budget recommendations for DHS. So if you don't have your governor's budget book, the pages will be kind enough to pass those out to you. So DHS could come on down right now. Welcome. Welcome, Mr. Lights.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members. I think we were going through some of the pages that members had requested additional information. And where, if I recall, we left off was we were on item number...
Rehab services coverage.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On page 69 of the bill.
Very good.
And I'll ask Mr. Greenman and his...
Dave Greenman with the Department of Human Services. I started to describe this proposal last time. It's got several pieces to it. Essentially, what we're addressing here is our, a couple things. One is our prior authorization process. As I mentioned last time, we pay for about, the DHS pays for about 80,000 prior authorizations each year for our fee-for-service programs for people who are, for services or people who are subject to specific service limits. And right now our process is mainly a paper-based process. We use a vendor to review requests for authorization for payment. And it's often a process that takes some amount of time. And people often have to wait a while to get the authorization they want. What we're doing with this proposal is a few things. We're going to modernize our prior authorization system. We're going to require... Most providers to use to submit their authorizations electronically through our DHS Minute system, and we're also we believe that by submitting them electronically, we can potentially use our vendor. We can use our electronic system to review authorizations for services and make the decisions much more quickly than we have in the past. And also, our assumption is that we get decisions made more quickly, like I said, and also have to use our vendor to review our authorizations only when things are a little more complicated, when the decision is less straightforward. The other thing we're going to do with this proposal is have different ways, have a different way in which to authorize services. Right now, we authorize... one-time service thresholds through our prior authorization process. We're authorized for a specific service or for a specific provider. What we're going to do with our new system is require authorization for an episode of treatment, which means that somebody won't necessarily have to get authorized for a specific service, but they'll be authorized for an episode of treatment. So if they need to change services while getting an episode of treatment, they can do that under the same prior authorization. And so those are some of the changes that we're making to improve the system, and we believe it'll make for a better experience for the clients and for the providers as well. The other piece of this proposal has to do with one of our therapies. It's we pay for what's known as specialized maintenance therapy as part of our therapy services. When we took a look at covered services, one of the things we looked at was, you know, where can we make some changes that would save us some money and have as little impact as possible on clients? And obviously, any change in service is going to have an impact on clients, and we need to take that seriously. One of the areas that we looked at was specialized maintenance therapy. It's a service we pay approximately $1.6 million a year for, and we primarily the service is provided, I believe, by one provider in the state, and it's I believe the geographic area in which the services are provided is fairly limited as well. And so many people in the state don't get this service. And when we looked at it, we thought most of the people who are getting the service have a mental health diagnosis, which isn't always the... we felt that these folks, when we worked with our mental health unit, that some of these folks may be better served with mental health services rather than occupational therapy services. And so that's our proposal, is to no longer cover specialized maintenance therapy as an as a service.
Very good, Mr. Greenman. Are there any questions? Okay, very good. Next, if you turn to the reduced basic care rates, and that is page 78.
Mr. Chair, this proposal is to reduce basic care rates by 0.5%, effective July 1 of 2011. In 2009, just as a little background, in 2009, the legislature enacted a 3% reduction in a set of services that they refer to as basic care services. Those services were never defined in statute, and so DHS took a look at what other cuts were being made in 2009 and made some determinations about what those services would include. And specifically what they include are, let me just turn to that page, things like outpatient hospital. This would include medical supplies, durable medical equipment, ambulatory surgery, lab testing, eyeglasses, and prosthetics. This rate cut would not include pharmacy, dental, mental health, physician and professional services, and transportation services. One of the things that was enacted in 2010, the legislature expanded the definition of basic care services to include therapies. So this reduction would affect physical therapy, occupational therapy, and speech therapy.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Greenman. Are there any questions? If not, then we'll move along to our next item, and that is to reduce PMAP and MRC funding. You can find that on page 82.
Mr. Chair, for a number of years, the state has had a program that has supported the costs of medical education at clinical training sites around the state and reimburses those sites for a portion of the clinical training costs that they incur as a result of having residents and students in place. And that's funded through two different mechanisms. One is administered through the state health, well, both are administered through the state health department, but the one is more of a direct payment from some tobacco funds. This other portion that is being addressed in this page is a carve out of the capitation capitation rates that are paid to health plans for administering services to clients under the PMAP program. What happens is a portion of those rates are carved out. That money is transferred to the health department, and then those funds are transferred down to the clinical training sites. What is being proposed here, and that supports the training, by the way, of a variety of physicians, dentists, pharmacists, advanced practice nurses, and other types of medical professionals. What's being proposed here is to reduce that funding. The governor has indicated that the page, as originally proposed, had a reduction of about $12.8 million per year, or about $26 million over the biennium. The governor has indicated that he would be buying back about half of that a reduction. So the reduction would be more on the order of about $13 million over the biennium.
Excuse me, we have a question. Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner Leitz, have you had any contact with some of the residency programs that will be drastically affected by this? And have you heard anything from them that would indicate that some of those might actually close?
Mr. Chair, Representative Huntley, personally, I have not had that conversation. We do know that this will have some impacts on the ability of programs to support certain things. We believe this is still a healthy amount of funding relative to how it's done in other states. But yeah, there will be some reduction. The reduction will cause some impacts at training sites.
Representative Huntley?
No, that's it.
Mr. Lights, I have a question then as well. Regarding the medical training sites, will it, you mentioned that it won't eliminate them, but it will prohibit the number of training sites or number of those that are residents in training, is that correct?
Mr. Chair, what the program does is it supports basically as training sites work with the various training institutions to host residents and trainees to in the field where they're actually getting their medical training. And what the Merck program does is actually to then and as a result of doing that, they incur certain costs. Trainees are less efficient, for example, than full-fledged doctors are or full-fledged advanced practice nurses during that training period. And so the sites themselves bear some costs as a result of that. And what the Merck program does is to actually offset a portion of those costs. It's something, I believe, if last calculation I remember, something below 10% of those total costs. But it's an additional amount of money that goes to them to help support that. With the proposal here, that funding is reduced in support. Now, what that will mean at some of the sites is that there will be some impacts. What we don't know is what those specific impacts will be from a site perspective, whether that will mean fewer slots or whether that will mean that they will simply continue to host the same number of slots but make up those costs elsewhere within their training. But we do understand that there will be some impacts as a result of this. What we don't know for certain is the specificity of those.
Very good. Thank you. You may continue. Was that it? Excuse me. Any other questions regarding the Merck and the PMAP? If not, then we'll move along down to our next item, and is that MA hospital and surcharge and payment rates, and that can be found on page 83.
Mr. Chair, this item increases the medical assistance surcharge that's on hospitals. It's currently levied at a rate of 1.56% and has been in place, that surcharge has been in place since 1994. What's occurred over the past several years is that about half the states in the country, as a result of some of the budget pressures that states have been facing, have increased.
Excuse me, Ms. Lights, I hate to interrupt, but we do have a quorum, so I'd like to call the meeting officially to order. And then with that also, I believe that Representative McElf Patrick would like to approve the minutes, is that correct? I figured so much. I saw it in your eyes, the twinkle in your eyes. So if all in favor of approving the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Very good. Mr. Lights, you may continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There has been a number of these sorts of taxes that have been increased surcharges that have been increased over the course of the past 10 or 15 years. What this proposal does is to take the current 1.56% medical assistance surcharge and increase the rate of that surcharge to 4.45%. The mechanism here really is the hospitals have a certain amount of net revenue. The surcharge percentage is then charged against that net revenue. That revenue is brought into the state. We use a portion of that money then to actually increase rates that are being paid back to hospitals. So in the aggregate of the dollars that are brought in from the surcharge, there's a payback through an increase in hospital rates of 24% from July 1st, 2011 through September 30th of 2012, and by 18.5% from October 1st, 2012 through September of 2013. And what this payback to the hospitals does is basically net out or offset approximately 44% of the cost of the surcharge.
Very good, Mr. Lights. Any questions? I have one, Mr. Lights. Would that then just be passed on to the ratepayer then?
Mr. Chair, yeah, the way it would work is this would serve as a net in a sense a net reduction in the payment that the hospitals receive. They'll be paying back in a portion of their net revenues. They'll receive back some portion of that, although not fully, the payment back from in terms of rates. How that reduction in the rate or how the surcharge gets passed on to payers would be a matter of negotiation between the hospital and the payers as they enter into their annual negotiations around service for networks.
Very good. Thank you. You may continue. That was it on that, Mr. Lights?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Then we can proceed to the last page, which is managed care surcharge and payment rates, and that is on the last page. No, the next page. I'm sorry. Page 84.
Mr. Chair, this item is a managed care surcharge and payment rate. Currently, and since 1992, the state has had a surcharge in place on HMO revenues of 0.6%. That rate is being, the governor is proposing to increase that surcharge rate from 0.6% up to 4.3%. In a manner similar to what I just described from the for the hospital perspective, what will occur here is that in order to offset the surcharge increase, we would then increase the amount paid in our capitation rates to the health plans for medical assistance in Minnesota care, as well as for, I might also add that I forgot to mention, is this would also be levied on county-based purchasing plans as well. The rate of increase that HMOs would receive would be 8.88% from January 1st, 2012 through June 30th of 2012. And then beginning in July of that year, the rate would be increased to 3.7%. County-based purchasing would be increased the rates of 10.32% from January through June of 2012, and then 4.3% starting in July of 2012. This has the effect of offsetting about 86% of the surcharge that's being levied on the plans.
Thank you. Representative Franzen has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Leitz, as a, I have a county-based purchasing plan in my district, and it covers quite a few counties there. I'm just wondering, what is the impact on the county-based purchasing with the surcharge, and how do you think it's going to affect them?
Mr.
Leitz.
Mr. Chair, the initial levying of the surcharge will bring in revenue from the county-based purchasing plan into the state. They'll obviously feel a revenue reduction as a result of that. The payback of the money will go out through managed care rates. Those who are serving more MA clients on those will receive obviously a higher share of those dollars. So, to the extent that the county-based purchasing plans are serving more MA clients, they would receive a higher share of the payback. In the aggregate, the payback is about 88% of the levy. We think from the CBP plans. I think it's our analysis so far, Representative, that they would most of the county-based purchasing plans would receive close to what they would be paying in for the actual surcharge increase. But we can look at that more specifically.
Representative Franzen, follow up.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Leitz. Have you actually talked to any of the county-based purchasing plans to find out what their thoughts are?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we have had contact from the organization that is representing the county-based purchasing plans. I believe we have a meeting set up next week with them to have some discussions on this, and I think a number of other issues related to purchasing and payment.
Very good. Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chairman and Commissioner Leitz, have you talked to Preferred One? I don't see their lobbyist here, but... because they don't participate in the PMAP program, so they essentially will lose 100% of what the surcharge is. Have you talked to them?
Mr. Chair, Representative Huntley, we've heard from a number of the plans. There are some redistributional effects that occur as a result of this proposal. The proposal itself is levied on the full market, which includes commercial business as well as Medicaid, and doesn't include Medicare, but it would include Medicaid and the commercial business. And then the payback itself occurs via the managed care rates. So for those plans that do less business or who have a higher proportion of business in the commercial market, that is something that would cause a redistribution. We have had a discussion. We have been made aware of that issue. I think we're very open to working however we can with the plans to try to figure out a mechanism for payback that would mitigate those redistributions where we can, but we are aware of them.
Representative Hundley?
Well, the gentleman that represents Preferred One is now in the room. I don't know if he wants to comment on...
Mr. Griffin, would you like to comment on this? Please welcome.
We're talking about the effect of the HMO surcharge on Preferred One. Since my understanding is you would lose 100% of what you pay. You get nothing back.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Huntley, my name is Phil Griffin. I'm a lobbyist, and I represent Preferred One, which is a health plan. that was started and is still owned by North Memorial Fairview Hospitals and a group of physicians here in town. And yes, Mr. Chairman, in response to your question or statement, Representative Huntley, Preferred One does not have a direct contract with the state to do PMAP, and so 100% of the MA surcharge would be a loss for Preferred One. We had some discussion about this last session. There's some question about why Preferred One doesn't have this. We started our HMO quite a bit later than all of the other plans in order to get into the market. We felt that we needed to get into the private market. It was hard to contract with physicians and hospitals, including our owners, just using the public programs because the payment rates were so much lower. To meet our Rule 101 requirements, we have entered into a joint venture with UCare Minnesota, and the program that we have entered into allowed the state to expand statewide so that you could have the PMAP program statewide when you wanted to do it. Otherwise, UCare didn't have a large enough out-of-state network, and the state would not have met the waiver requirements of the 1115 waiver to have a choice of plans in all 87 counties. And that's the quick and dirty history behind the program. But in answer to your question, we are very concerned about this proposal from the governor's office, and it would make it very difficult for us to continue to do business.
Representative Huntley, thank you for bringing that to our attention. Do you have anything to follow up on that?
Well, Mr. Chair and Mr. Griffin, you're going to, what's the total amount of this, Mr. Lights, if you could tell me what the total amount of the surcharge is? Percentage-wise.
Mr. Chair, Representative Huntley, the surcharge is 4.3%.
Representative
so,
Huntley?
Okay, well, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Griffin, then does that put you at a 4% competitive disadvantage?
Mr. Griffin?
Mr. Chairman,
in the commercial
yes.
market?
Yes.
Representative Huntley?
Well, Mr. Chair, again, they have to compete on their commercial market, and they're going to be at a severe uncompetitive position with the other health plans because of the fact that they do not get any repayment from this.
But it appears that we need to work on this a little bit more in depth then. Good thing it's only a proposal.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I appreciate the time that you've given us this morning. Our company is running the numbers, and I will be visiting with many of you as we move through this. If you have questions, I'd be happy to answer them at another time. Thank you very much.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Griffin, Mr. Lights, and Mr. Greenman. Thank you very much for your testimony. We'll move down along then to we're going to continuing our care administration money follow person grant. And I'd like to call up Alex Bartolik and Gene Wood. Welcome to testify. And there is a handout in your packet regarding their testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Gene Wood, Aging and Adult Services Division, Department of Human Services. Ms. Bartolik and I today will be talking about money follows the person. I'll be doing more of the background piece, and Ms. Bartolik will be covering the strategies. We see this money follows the person grant from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid as an opportunity for the state to shape a more responsive home and community-based services system. CMS sees the purpose of this grant opportunity as a way of supporting the transition of medical assistance participants from institutions into the community, and this has been a long-standing policy of Minnesota to be working in this direction very strongly. They also see the purpose as rebalancing each state's long-term care system to achieve a sustainable balance of institutional and community-based services. And again, this is a long-standing policy that Minnesota has, particularly around making sure that we have a sustainable program in place. A little bit about the process. The grant application went in January 7th. We were awarded notification February 22nd, and we are still in the process of negotiating the terms and conditions with CMS. So there are some of those items that we will not be able to answer, particularly when it comes to certain outcomes. Going to slide number four, I'd like to talk a little bit about the background on Money Follows the Person, which was authorized by Congress through the 2005 Deficit Reduction Act. Up until now, about 29 states have been participating in it because the funding was limited. Additional funding became available, and so Minnesota now joins 12 other states in this award to be able to operate Money Follows the Person. Thus far nationally, about 12,000 people have been transitioned from the community to the community from institutional settings as a result of this program. And then, of course, additional funding was made available for these other states through the Affordable Care Act and extended the Money Follows the Person program, which, as we understand from other states, was very popular and very useful as they went through their transformations.
Ms. Wood?
Yes.
I just want to make a comment. We have plenty of time, so if there's a question, we do encourage you to answer because we have plenty of time with us today. So, and with that, I pause to ask a question myself, and with the hesitation of asking a dumb question. In this program, in 2005, that with the Deficit Reduction Act, were there new software then developed for this to follow this and help the MFP?
Mr. Chair, I'm unaware of any specific sort of software that was developed for Money Follows the Person by, I'm assuming you were thinking the federal government may have done some software?
Well, in developing this program for DHS, is it done on paper and pen, or is it a computer program software that follows, Money Follows the Person?
Money Follows the Person. Money Follows the Person as a, Mr. Chair, as a concept, and money always follows a person. You know, we do have systems at the Department of Human Services that knows precisely what is paid for each individual and for what services. This concept of money follows the person, and again, money always follows a person as a benefit, as an MA benefit. But the idea behind this is really the transition of individuals so that we are spending less money in institutional settings and more money in community settings. And so the idea was that money would follow the person out of the institution into the community.
Very good. So it's a new program, but using old software. Is that correct? Correct statement?
That would be correct.
Yeah, just retrofitted for this program.
Mm-hmm.
Very
that,
good.
That would be a way, yeah.
Thank you, Ms. Wood.
That's a good way of thinking of it.
Great. And Representative Franzen has a question as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Bartolik, additional funding through the Affordable Care Act available from 2011 to 2016, no cost extension to 2020. Could you explain that?
Sure. What it means is that the federal government has authorized and appropriated funding. They have identified it to be spent in the years 2011 to 2016. But if states have not spent the entire amount of the money that has been awarded to them, they can apply for a no-cost extension, meaning no additional cost to the federal government. The state can then continue working on its reforms that it outlined in its proposal.
Thank you, Ms. Wood. Representative Franzen, do you have a follow-up?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Ms. Lights, if they need more money come 2016, would that be available? Would the government just write out another check?
Yes, Ms. Woods.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative, I am unable to predict what Congress will do.
Representative Franzen.
Sorry, I'm just a pessimist. So what happens then if they run out of money, Congress has no money to authorize, would this be a program that we would be in X many years, people coming to my door and saying, please don't cut us, we're the most important here?
Ms. Wood, if this is not particularly your area of expertise and you would refer to another to get back to her, you certainly are welcome to do that. I'm not sure, Representative Franzen, if Ms. Wood's is, the proper question is directed to the proper person. But you may move. You may proceed.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative, the purpose of this program is to put better systems into place. And Ms. Bartolik, when she presents, will talk about the strategies that we intend to put in place. This doesn't actually add, a lot of additional money into a fund to buy additional services. It adds some money, but not a lot. And so the real jewel of this is to be able to change systems and have them function better, and those would stay in place.
Very good. You may continue.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Moving to slide number 5, we do have a copy there of the actual announcement that talks about Minnesota receiving for a period of time, and it is roughly 5 years, $187.4 million to improve community services and support people in their homes rather than institutions. And I'm going to quickly go to slide number 6 to talk a little bit about the benefits to Minnesota and a little bit about the structure, which I think might help answer some of the questions that we have about the sustainability of this particular effort. Minnesota really sees this as an opportunity to work with aging individuals and our persons with disabilities that have the most complex needs. I think that Minnesota has been very successful in working with many, many different populations and making sure that they are served effectively in the community. But we know that there are some individuals that have some very complex needs that we have not been as effective with as we can be. And when I say people with complex needs, we're really talking about people with multiple diagnoses. They may have mental health diagnoses. They may be medically complex. They may have complex activities of daily living. And for a variety of reasons, and when we get to talking about the strategies, we have not probably been able to serve them as well as we've been able to. So again, this is really aimed toward individuals that have complex needs.
Ms. Wood?
Yes.
A question for you. How does the Department of Health come up with the number of $187.4 million, and knowing that we need a first-year funding of $13.4 million, how are those numbers gathered and then allocated for our services here?
Mr. Chair, we did do a budget, and we projected some. Most of this money is services money. It's not necessarily new money. It is a way of being able to spend our current funding, and we did it in a budget, and we did it with projections based on the number of persons that we thought we would be able to serve in the first year.
So if I may, on your slide it says these are new dollars. That's not a correct statement.
Yeah, it's not. The press release does say new dollars. That's not entirely accurate. And again, fortunately, I didn't write this press release. The Health and Human Services did, and so.
The U.S. Health and Human Services.
U.S. Health and Human Services.
Very good. Thank you. Any other questions? You may proceed.
Okay. The next dot points on slide number 6 talk a little bit about the structure of what this money will cover and its intended purposes. The first one talks about, the second dot point actually, talks about enhanced federal match for services for eligible demonstration participants. And one of the benefits that we do receive is that we are currently spending money in medical assistance for these individuals, and we become eligible to receive an additional match for these dollars, about 25% more than what we are receiving now. That funding needs to go into a pool of funds that we can continue to spend on individuals, and again, these are individuals that have complex needs that we might be able to serve in a different way.
Ms. Wood, excuse me, Ms. Schmale, Mr. Fitzer, I hope I'm not abusing my chairman power, but I have two teachers from my district, and they were taught some of my children, and they're just leaving. I wanted to acknowledge Mr. Fitzer and Ms. Schmale from the Delano School District. Thank you. Keep up the great work. I'm sorry. I hope I didn't abuse my authority here, but Ms. Wood, you may continue.
Okay. The next dot point talks about the administrative cost reimbursements for the implementation of these activities. And this is funding that will come to the department to pay for staff and capacity that is specifically focused on being able to look at the various silos, at the various policies that we have in place that may not be well serving people with complex needs. And then we also will have the advantage of having national technical assistance. You know, specifically 29 other states have been doing this for 5-6 years, and we will continue to be able to learn from their experience. Going to slide number 7, please understand that there is more than continuing care. There's more than disability services and aging services involved in this collaboration. We have people within the department, and then we, of course, also have stakeholders outside the department that have worked with us up until this date to make Money Follows the Person application a reality. Our collaboration includes housing, state-operated services, healthcare and managed care, adult and children's mental health, and these again are all departments, divisions within the Department of Human Services that have come to the table and have provided us with information and ideas about how to pursue better serving complex individuals, because a lot of these people go across all of these divisions. Someone may be touching them in some way. Stakeholder engagements have been with counties and lead agencies, providers, consumers, families, housing organizations, and advocacy groups. And again, a lot of folks put a lot of hard work into helping us conceptualize and put together this application and the ideas that were favorable to getting us awarded these funds. Let me talk a little bit about the requirements because they can be relatively specific from CMS. Eligible individuals for this demonstration, the folks that we will count, the people that will become a part of our outcomes, are Medicaid eligible that have that are receiving medical assistance for at least one day prior to their enrollment with us under this Money Follows the Person grant. And they have to reside or have been residing for at least 90 consecutive days in a qualified institution. On the next slide, qualified institutions include hospitals, nursing facilities, intermediate care facilities for the developmentally disabled, and institutions for mental diseases to the extent services there are covered by medical assistance. When they move to the community, CMS requires that they, in order to be counted, that they be moving to a qualified residence. And there on slide 11, you can see what the qualified residents are. A home owned or leased by the individual or the individual's family, an apartment with an individual lease with lockable access and egress, which includes living, sleeping, bathing, and cooking areas over which they have some control. And the third category is a residence in a community-based residential setting in which no more than four unrelated individuals reside. And so you'll see that there are some limitations and structures on the people that we can count. That doesn't mean that in developing this new system, new protocols, new policies, that we wouldn't be impacting other individuals in a favorable way.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Alex Bartolik, and I'm going to talk a little bit about the strategies that we're going to use. These are strategies that were identified after talking with other members within the department as well as stakeholders about if we have a chance to do something different and demonstrate how different services, different benefits can help people and be cost effective in the long run and later either replace or redefine our services, what would that look like? And we looked at where the gaps were, where the problems were. We also looked at where we've had promising practices, but it might have been in one part of the department, not necessarily implemented for people across all of our practices. So in doing this, we were trying to see what was the most cost effective, what would reduce the need for more expensive institutional services, what would create stability, increase quality of life, and increase outcomes. And for many people, this does include living in your own place, having a job, being able to have good health as we go forward. So we want to break down the silos of some of our programs and figure out how to streamline services. And the activities here will help us, again, for our system, not just for the individuals that qualify. There are four major strategies that we've identified. One is how to look at transition services. What happens when people are in a hospital, a nursing home, someplace, and they need to move into a different setting for other reasons? How do we support that? We want to look at implementing and advancing more consistent best practices to serve people who have very complex needs that sometimes have not been well served in our system. We want to look at better linkages between healthcare, the community support, and housing, because we know there's often gaps that people experience. And then lastly, which is probably the very core of how this program started, was decrease use of some institutional settings and really increase the use of home and community-based services. The first strategy around simplifying and improving the effectiveness of transitions, I'm on slide 13 if you're following along, is really looking at, we have a lot of different ways of helping people and different practices in different areas. But if we look specifically at people on medical assistance, for example, who've been in a hospital and go into a nursing home or go into another setting, how do we help them move back to the community more effectively? We also wanted to look at more than just doing this for people who are on medical assistance. And we have some practices and programs right now that are helping private pay individuals. For example, people who are older, who private pay in a hospital, they might need to go into a nursing home for rehab. How do we make sure we're reaching them right away and helping them get back into their home with other services and supports that are there so that they don't rely on more expensive services, spend down, lose their housing, and now we've started another cycle. There's another number of opportunities to look for transition. When you look across the department, we have different kinds of case management. We have housing supports in different areas. We have a lot of different services, and this is going to give us a chance to say what's the most effective, and can we redefine this and really have the strongest system in place to help people through the transitions, and this will be part of the demonstration. The next strategy is looking at how do we, and this is on slide 14 if you're following along, it's strategy 2, how do we advance those practices and benefits to increase stability in community life? We have many people who live in their community with different home and community-based services, and when things happen in their lives, sometimes they end up having to access more expensive services because we're not as agile at supporting them effectively earlier on. So we want to look at how we can do this. One is looking at collaboration from all the different disciplines and programs that exist to really support people effectively. Another one is to look at how can we increase the stability and the capacity and knowledge of some of our community-based providers, for example, and decrease the use of crisis and other short-term services by having folks be better able to manage some of the things that happen with folks. How do we collaborate differently with healthcare? A lot of people run into issues and we might have a provider trying to manage services, and we really need to work differently with the doctors and the physicians and the clinics that they're engaged with. We also want to look at an individual strategy to allocate benefits. And many of the struggles that are going on is how do we say how much money is enough for individuals and how do we align it differently. So we want to be able to look at this as an opportunity to move forward with that. This third strategy on page 15 is how do we increase the stability of individuals in the community by really strengthening the connections between healthcare and the community support and housing. And again, if you can't find a place to live that's affordable and accessible, you end up often going into a program where providers then are managing the housing because it's the only place you can go. And we're trying to promote very flexible ways of supporting people that can adapt to what they need at that time. One part of the strategy is to enhance and strengthen the whole Minnesota Help Network. This is the senior linkage line, the disability linkage line, a web reference to resources, getting access to assistance when you need it. It's something that's available to all citizens of Minnesota, and so we can really do a good job of helping people when they have a need, regardless of how their funding goes or where they're living across the state, and better able to meet that, as well as helping people who are on public services get access to some additional assistance. We want to make sure we're really understanding housing and having access to housing and also getting assistance in helping people obtain and maintain their housing. So we have a number of strategies we'd like to build on there. And then employment is another area. We know that many people want to work, and there are ways we can help them get engaged in the workforce, and we want to build on those strategies so that employment and having sustainable ways to kind of build out of poverty and contribute to the communities is also important. The fourth strategy that we are looking at is how do we actually decrease our reliance on some of the institutional care and increase home and community-based services. We have a lot of the previous strategies will address that. It will address people who don't need to stay in a nursing home and could move out. But we very specifically have intermediate care facilities for people with developmental disabilities where some of them want to close or downsize, or some of them people would like to move, and we haven't had a good way of addressing that, and we want to be able to come up with a planning process to really look at what does it take to go to the next step where there are choices to use home and community-based services and help providers transition their practices. So we are looking at a plan to be able to enable those closures and downsizing. And the second major strategy is to look at how we can reduce the admission, readmission, and length of stay in children's psychiatric hospitals. And this is an area, I think you've heard testimony before about Wilmer and some other places. We want to help kids stay at home with their families, and we know that there's different strategies that can go into place in order to make that work. So that's a summary of these strategies. Now, this does not mean we have every detail about how this is going to work. We know these are the things that will make a difference. There's a lot of consensus around stakeholders, and so as Jean had mentioned, we're in the process of going through the terms and conditions of what the grant is requiring us. We will be working with stakeholders in order to further develop this, and we'll be phasing it. We'll look at what are the things that we can do quicker, what are the things we might have to do more planning to implement. But it's a very exciting opportunity to really further what Minnesota has been doing and help us address some of the gaps.
Thank you, Ms. Bartolik and Ms. Wood. We have a question from Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to say that thank you for the presentation. I'm excited to hear about this. I saw that we had gotten the grant, and I didn't really know what it was about, so I'm really glad to know. And I just wanted to kind of state what my understanding is, because I think this is a great opportunity. I sent a note over to Mr. Walsh there to ask him if he knows what our total budget is here for long-term care, residential care, and I don't know the number, and maybe he'll come up with it, but we spend an enormous amount of money in this area. Mm-hmm. And we here in this committee, I think bipartisanly, agree that we need to reform how we do things, and we need to get as much out of our health care dollar in the state as we possibly can. And we're trying to squeeze our dollars here as fast as we can go. And one of the problems we face in a very bad budget situation is that we don't have the money to transition into new systems. We're always talking about how we need to reform, but we can't get from here to there without figuring out how to do things in a new way. We can't just take elderly and fragile people and say, get out of here, go live in your house. It just doesn't work that way. These are real people with real needs. Mm-hmm. And so to get an opportunity like this to try to really figure out how to do this better, saving the state money in the long term, mm-hmm. I think is just a tremendous opportunity. And so I think your answer to Representative Franson was really good. And, you know, just to reiterate, I think, please correct me if I'm getting it wrong, but then we're figuring out how to do something differently. Mm-hmm. So once we figure that out, we do it differently and presumably at a lower cost and giving people better service. The other thing I'm hearing from your presentation is, and maybe I'm reading this in, but, you know, these are people that have very complex needs. We are giving them better freedom, better autonomy. People don't want to live in institutions. They want to live in their own homes. They want to be able to choose their own services. This is an opportunity to enhance freedom and autonomy for a lot of folks who don't have that on their own because they have various kinds of disabilities or they're elderly and they have different kinds of needs. So I think this is a wonderful opportunity, and I'm glad that we are a state that's able to take advantage of this. We've led the way in a lot of health care reform, and I expect, with all the good folks working on this, just as fast as we can, that we're going to be leading some more. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative. Yes, this is to be commended, and we are very excited about the program. You're doing exactly what all of us want to be done, making things more efficient, effectively, and cost affordably, but more importantly, keeping those folks in their homes, and that's the blessing of this program. So keep up the good work. And with that, I'll turn it over to our chairman. Representative Abler has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm sorry I've been in and out discussing. I can't believe how many meetings I've had today. This is seems like a nice thing, and we're continuing our tradition of all the innovative, flexible living we've done. And maybe you already mentioned it, but in the 13.4, how does that compare with how much that's going to be planning and how much is going to go to services, and is that still what you're figuring out? And that's my first question.
Mr. Chair, we're still organizing some of the terms and conditions to understand it. There certainly is some of the funds that will cover some of the administrative costs in order to really focus on it. Some of the dollars will be for services. One thing I want to clarify that I think the press release was really misleading, that I think Gene tried to address, is Minnesota is currently spending a lot of money on these people. What we're doing is we're trying to move them to our home and community-based service system at less cost, and some of the grant funding gives us an enhanced match in order to pay for some of the new services and demonstrate whether they're effective before we go on. But we are in the process of negotiating with CMS what our budget will actually be, and we can get back to you with some of those details.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative?
Well, and it's fascinating. And so do you think we can actually buy some, can we actually use this to buy things that we've always wanted to buy, like, you know, some housing options and some things that have been, is this going to be creative kind of money, or is it still undetermined? And
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Bartolik?
A little bit is undetermined. However, we do know that part of the demonstration and part of their money is to allow us to buy things we typically have not made available through our home and community-based services or the Medicaid program. And if those are effective, we're understanding that there's probably some parameters around it, but that we're going to be able to put it into our home and community-based program to allow it to occur. And housing. And what does it take to help people stay in their house is definitely an area that we will be able to do some things we have not in the past.
And Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler.
And so is this a project that you're going to do on your own, or is there going to be a legislative approval of a list of things that we're going to ratify, or how do you imagine that to go? It's quite a bit of money, and we're a little broke, and so we might have some ideas of our own about what we would do. Have you thought about that?
Ms. Bartolik?
Mr. Chair and Representative Abler, there is a process for any grant to go through, and because the legislature is meeting, there will be, I think it's a bill and a rider, you will be getting a request to accept this grant. We will have to, if you want to make changes in the strategies or there's other things, we should sit down and talk about it fairly quickly because we're negotiating right now with CMS the terms and conditions of what we will do with the dollars.
And Mr. Chair.
Representative.
And then, I mean, I Because right now we have, like, in the budget that was presented from your department, we actually reduced funding for sales and some other programs that we kind of like. And it's interesting to think we're going to create another sales program that we already have one we just made smaller that worked really well. Can we just make it really easy for the current providers that we wish could do more, just not to have a very minimal request to get some money to do what they already do well and not have a lot of burden on their part?
Ms. Bartolik?
Is that what you're thinking?
Mr. Chair and Representative, there's different parts of this program. Some things will be open for RFP processes for providers or lead agencies to come up with different ways of doing things and being able to fund that. But the bulk of the services are contingent. The service dollars are going to be contingent on people meeting the standards. They've been on Medicaid. They've been living in an institutional setting for 90 days or more. They're going to move out to a certain qualified setting, and they're using the package of services. So we can look at what are some of the gaps in helping them move effectively, but we can't take some of the service money and use it for people who don't meet that standard.
Right. Just one more question.
Representative Abel.
And is this to supplement, not supplant, or is this a way to, if we wanted to supplement some, that actually, is that possible? Is there any supplanting we're allowed to do, or is this all new services for these people? If this person would have left in 91 days anyway, and now they qualify based on the terms of this grant, do they qualify so we can actually get some mileage out of this in our tight budget time?
Mm-hmm. Ms. Bartolik?
Mr. Chair and Representative Abler, the grant allows us to count people who meet the conditions regardless of whether they would have left or not.
Okay.
Many of these people we will continue providing services. The grant provides some additional enhanced match, for example, for 12 months, assuming there may be some different services, but at the end of that 12-month period for that individual, that person needs to be able to be served within our system. And then through the grant, we can decide if there's other services that we want to make available as a state. So it uses our existing, we can get credit for what we were already going to do.
Okay, I'll leave it at that. Thank you. We can take some more of this offline, so thank you very much.
Representative Anderson has a question.
This is a little unclear. Is there going to be a certain report that you're supposed to be providing at a certain time about the results that you're finding? Or, like, is there a certain length of time that you're supposed to be doing this for? And then, like, after a year, are you supposed to give us results? After 2 years? And also, are you going to be putting together, like, a task force at all?
Can you take it? Sure.
Ms. Bartolik?
Mr. Chair, Representative, there will be some kind of a task force, and we probably won't have just one. We probably will have people working on strategies because there's a lot of work around each strategy. There's a lot of federal reporting, a lot. We can make those federal reports available, and to the extent that you would like status updates, we can provide that to you. But the grant does have conditions of reporting about how we've spent the money, what have been the outcomes, what have been the activities, and are they doing what we think they're going to be doing.
Right. Representative Anderson?
Mr. Chairman, so when do you see your first report? Do you have to do a report after a year, or when is your first report due?
Ms. Wood?
Mr. Chair, Representative, generally speaking, we have to do quarterly reports to the federal government, and then there are also annual reports.
Representative Anderson?
So, Mr. Chairman, how long will you be doing these reports? Is it you're going to be doing this up until 2016, or how long does this last, these reports?
Ms.
Wood?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it lasts for 5 years, so it's until 2016.
And, Mr. Chair, just to add, if we
Ms.
had
Bartolik?
A no-cost extension, it lasts for the duration of the engagement and contracting with CMS.
Representative Anderson, a follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Any other questions? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I had gotten the answer to my question, and so I just wanted to share with all of you. I mean, we all know we spend lots and lots of money on residential care for people, and it's, according to Mr. Walson, if I'm understanding correctly, it's about $1 billion in a biennium, and that's state and federal. That's a lot of money, and of course we have a lot of discussion around here about the rates that we pay and so on, and we know that we have a real problem paying nursing homes and other long-term care facilities, you know, what they really need to provide good care. So I'm just, again, really glad to see this moving forward and hope that we can get some real benefit out of it that will both enhance care for people that need it and help us better manage our budget in the future.
Very good. Ms. Bartolik, Ms. Wood, thank you for your testimony, and we wish you the best on the project.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
At this time, we'd like to call down Representative Quam. We will discuss House File 113. And all your paperwork regarding the bill is in your packet. All right, we need a representative to move Representative Quam's bill. Don't jump all at once, Representative Huntley.
I would move that House File 113 be approved.
Very good to move to taxes.
And sent to taxes.
And sent to taxes after today's work. Very good. With that. Representative Quam, you have an amendment as well. Would you like to move the? Can he move his amendment? Representative Huntley, would you?
I would move the A1 amendment, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Huntley. Now we need to vote on the amendment. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Minnesota's been sort of a paradox for the medical industry. We are cutting edge on delivery of medical care, innovative ways of doing better medical care for a more economical cost. We also are great at developing new medical techniques, new medical equipment, and being very innovative. One of the areas that we've sort of dropped behind on is the manufacturing of many of our medical devices are outside our state, outside our nation. And I feel, you know, with this bill, we're doing one step towards making Minnesota more comfortable, more a better place for medical companies to come to and have business in Minnesota and provide business across the nation, across the world. And the impetus of this is that, you know, regardless of the debate on the provider costs, you know, tax, that does add a 2% cost. And for businesses that are doing a predominant amount of their work outside of the state, it's an impediment to, you know, the competitiveness nationally. A good example is the Mayo Medical, Mayo Medical Lab facility down in Rochester. It does a great deal of work across the state and many nations. And because of the competitiveness and the short margins that you've got in this business, a 2% cut to the bottom line makes it less economical to do business in Minnesota. And because of the great amount of work from across the nation, they could do it any state. And so the impetus of this bill is to keep this business and others in the state, but also to show the medical innovators, whether it's biotechnology, genomics, even new innovations in regular medical care, that Minnesota is a place where you can come to, make it a destination for medical services. And I'd like to hand it off to my testifier, Mrs. Meyerly, who can give you details and expound on the specifics.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Quam. Mrs. Meyerly, welcome to the committee.
Representative McGough, my name is Kathy Meyerly. I'm an attorney for Mayo Clinic, and I'm speaking today on behalf of the clinic and Mayo Medical Laboratories in support of House File 113. As amended, It's our understanding and belief that the impact of this bill will serve to relieve only our Mayo Medical Laboratory operation of this Minnesota Care tax. The original version as drafted, while we appreciate Representative Quam's efforts in trying to relieve the entire Mayo operation, we recognize that that probably it was an impact on the health care access fund that was going to be more than we could ask for during this particular session. As Representative Quam said, this bill is important to Mayo Medical Laboratories because this is a tax that is uniquely imposed on our reference laboratory and not on its competitors. Mayo Medical Labs is the third largest reference laboratory in the country. It has two competitors, and they have chosen not to have operations in the state of Minnesota. They're both publicly traded companies, whereas Mayo Medical Laboratories is a wholly owned subsidiary of the Mayo Clinic operation. What Mayo Medical Labs does is provide high-quality esoteric testing for human biological specimens. Now, what this means is that we don't perform the routine cholesterol and blood glucose tests that every hospital can do, but rather we provide that testing that is unique or rare that requires a high degree of skill and expertise in order to get a reliable and good result. MML's business philosophy is actually different from its competitors as well. It focuses on providing services to its clients to support their routine laboratory operations so that the testing can stay as close to the patient as possible. We think that's a good business philosophy. Its competitors, conversely, often take all of that laboratory testing out of the community and do it at a regional center, and therefore you don't have the laboratory personnel even being employed in the local hospitals and the clinics. MML has 700 employees. 500 of those are in Rochester. We have two other locations, one in Jacksonville, Florida, and one in Andover, Massachusetts. Every day there are five cargo flights that land at the Rochester International Airport and deliver specimens. One of these actually is a FedEx Boeing 727-200. It's got a 50,000-pound payload capacity, and it is bringing specimens literally from around the world to our operation to be tested. On any one day, on average, we test 30,000 specimens from our clients. There's 4,000 clients in all 50 states and in 80 countries around the world, and on an annual basis, that means we perform about 12 million tests on over 4.5 million patients. Our view is these aren't patients in Minnesota receiving medical care in Minnesota. These are patients in their home communities where they don't have this technical expertise, and the clients have chosen to send the specimen here so we can report the results back and the local doctors in the local communities can provide the necessary medical services to their patients. MML is a taxable entity. We pay corporate income taxes, but on top of that, we pay the Minnesota Care Tax on our gross revenues. And this additional 2% tax creates a real impediment for our competitiveness. The reference testing laboratory is very competitive. Our clients are highly price sensitive, and it's a challenge constantly for us to be able to pass this tax along to our clients. In addition, since Mayo Medical Laboratories is a wholly owned subsidiary of Mayo Clinic, its profits don't go to shareholders. After it meets all of its obligations to its employees and to its tax entities, the money goes to support the research and education missions of Mayo Clinic. So the net effect of the tax is that about $4 million a year is being diverted from those vital, what we think, research and education missions. So House File 113 would exempt any entity that from the provider tax, if that entity has 60% or more of its revenues from patients and sources located outside the state of Minnesota. Well over 60% of MML's clients and patients are from outside Minnesota, and so we would be able to take advantage of this exemption.
Thank you, Ms. Meyerly, for your testimony. Any questions from our group, Representative Huntley? Huntley first, I'm sorry.
Well, Mr. Chair and Ms. Meyerly, I just want to make clear that you said the routine kind of things that somebody went to a Mayo Clinic in Minnesota and had their blood glucose measured would not be affected by what you're attempting to do here.
Mr. Chair, Representative Huntley, that's correct. The laboratory only does those rare tests, and routine tests that could be done in a local hospital lab are not part of our book of business.
Representative Huntley?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think, again, as we talked about earlier, this, I think, puts currently the Mayo Clinic at a disadvantage competing with these other labs around the country, and most of what they're doing there is just blood samples sent in to here. The patients are not in Minnesota. Most of them are elsewhere, so I think this is a good approach. I'm not sure the language is correct yet, but I think it does make the Mayo Clinic more competitive with these other two labs.
Very good. Representative Hosh, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the premise of this bill isn't necessarily a bad one, but at this point I feel relatively uninformed. I'm wondering, Mr. Chair, where a fiscal note would be.
It's a revenue analysis, so we do not get that information. Taxes will.
Well, Mr. Chair, I mean, part of our committee's jurisdiction is Minnesota Care and the Healthcare Access Fund, and it was even mentioned in the testimony that the reason for the amendment was to reduce the impact that would have on the Healthcare Access Fund. The governor's budget had several thousand people originally to be losing care on the Healthcare Access Fund. He's changed that now with the new revenue forecast, and the Healthcare Access Fund is roughly balanced at this time. But I want to be able to know what the impact is going to be on the Healthcare Access Fund. If it has a negative effect, what tools are going to be used to try to bring it back into balance? And the work that this committee does is very much in that jurisdiction. I think this is premature at the time. And it's not being for or against the bill at this time, but I have a responsibility to have answers to these questions, and I don't think this committee is ready for that.
Very good. I recognize that, Representative Hosh, but we do not receive the financial analysis that will go to taxes, so it's not in our jurisdiction. Representative Franzen has a question.
No, I was
going to. Representative Hosh.
Mr. Chair, will this bill then be coming back within the jurisdiction of the committee for being included in our omnibus bill, or what's the process that the bill will follow?
If it would be included, it would be in the tax omnibus bill.
So, Mr. Chair, so the tax committee will be making decisions that impact health care policy and access.
Excuse me for a moment. I'm going to turn this over to Representative Chairman Abler.
Well, I was kind of enjoying that, Mr. Chair.
Although I was capable of answering that, I'm sure.
I'll give you another crack at it. Representative Hosh, this is what I understand. This is my work. The merits of the bill, I think, are worthy. There's 1,000 employees down there, and if it's, I think that the denomination is like around $4 million. The face value of the bill is that, I don't even know what the size of the tax target is. I'll just tell you my lobbying that this should be part of the tax target, not part of our target. The question remains and recurs about what that does to the healthcare access fund, which at this point is $230 million in deficit at the last forecast. And the governor did some changes that we don't know what the balance in the healthcare access fund is based on the governor's work, because MMB couldn't tell us what it is and how they're going to bring it back into balance by removing the debit of the people above 200%. And I would think that we're all part of that discussion. So beyond that, I don't have any more information. Does that help you?
Helps us.
Very good. Thank you. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to start by saying that I think when we finally get to the point of full implementation of the Affordable Care Act, we are going to have, finally the opportunity to talk about the provider tax, whether we need to continue to collect the provider tax, or if Minnesota Care is going to be shifted in such a way with the exchange and the expansion of medical assistance that the provider tax is no longer necessary. And I think, you know, in a few years, we're going to have that discussion at this table if we're all still here together. I toured last year the University of Minnesota's labs, and they, of course, have a very extensive lab as well. And so I'm wondering, as you've crafted the bill, Representative Quam, if you've thought a little bit about the disparate treatment of various labs, not only the University of Minnesota lab, because they have, you know, an extensive lab on their campus, but also hospitals that have labs along the border in Duluth or Moorhead or down in the southwestern part of the state, if those labs are going to want the same treatment, and why we would choose one over those others if we're going to give this favorable tax treatment to one. And I know this is not the tax committee, but...
That's a valid question. Representative Quam?
Mr. Chair, Madam Representative, basically it's the intent is to make it not solely to one entity, because the intent is if you're bringing in business from outside the state of Minnesota, you're helping this economy. And we need to do that to augment the organic growth of our economy. So it's not limited there. The initial intent with my 20% would have included such a large scope of businesses that it would have not been possible to do this. So it was moved up to 60%. I think that there is room for a phase in, or room for looking at tweaking that 60%, but the intent is to be broader than one entity. The fiscal constraints that we find ourselves in and the balance of the fund have precipitated the increase of the percent. So, very open to improving this piece of legislation. But I think there is some urgency, because when tight economic times are here, the competitiveness gets to a point of where there are winners and losers. And I don't want to take the chance that in delaying to gain perfection, that we then lose a key component of the local economy there, plus the intent to imply that to the open, venture capital, anybody that's looking at expanding in Minnesota, we need to say that we realize we have some things that we could improve, and we're working on improving them, and here's an example. And that we're not there, we're not perfect, but we're making a good effort to progress to being a state where you can come and do business and be competitive in.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. So I'm guessing, and maybe you can illuminate on this point, but that the 60% threshold draws a line between the other facilities and Mayo.
Representative Quam.
Mr. Chair. It does for this facility. The initial line would have included multiple hospitals, both in the metro and around the fringes of the state, in multiple entities. I would love to have maintained that, because I honestly think when you look at the economic impact of bringing that business in, the profits that you tax, the property taxes, the income taxes, that whole sum, that once you get above about 20%, you're effectively having an impact equivalent to or greater than the provider tax on revenues going to the state. And that was sort of the impetus of the initial amount. It has been scaled back only because of the realities of the balance in the provider tax fund.
So, Representative Murphy?
Thank you, Representative Quam. So you would have liked to have done the 20%, but the impact on the health care access fund would have been too significant, and I appreciate that. And the impact on the health care access fund might be too significant given where we are right now with this legislation. So I'll go back to my original point that I think when we get to the full implementation of the Affordable Care Act, I think we can have then a full and comprehensive discussion of the provider tax, and I look forward to that time. Thank you.
Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm sorry to ask another question, but it just popped in my head with the testimony. Now, the Mayo Clinic, that is a nonprofit.
Yes, the hospital and the physician operation are not-for-profit.
Mr. Chair, to whoever may answer, now, in Minnesota, nonprofits are not subject to the sales and use tax or property taxes. The competitors that you reference, they are for-profit. Are they subject to taxes in their respective jurisdictions?
Ms. Marley.
Representative Hosh. Mayo Medical Laboratories is, like its two main competitors, Quest and LabCorp, a for-profit company. Mayo Medical Labs, its stock is 100% owned by Mayo Clinic, whereas the others are publicly traded. So actually, through its taxable entities in Rochester, Mayo Clinic is the largest single property taxpayer in the county.
Very good. Any other questions? Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just want to say I appreciate Representative Quam bringing this bill, and, you know, even if we can't do it this year, this biennium, I think it's important to educate people about this topic because, you know, the provider tax, although it provides very important funding for very important services, and it was in place long before I was here, it's problematic. It's philosophically a problematic way to fund. And you know, again, it has been very, very helpful and useful. But like Representative Murphy, I look forward to, under the Affordable Care Act, being able to get rid of it altogether because it does have these sort of unintended consequences that we in Rochester are very aware of. Because Mayo, I think, uniquely in the state, gets a lot of its business from outside the state. So this is a tax that I don't think any other state does anything like this, and maybe I'm wrong, but you know, it just creates some difficulties there, you know, that if we can find another way to fund the very important health care that we do provide, you know, I really do look forward to being able to get rid of this tax. And I know a lot of us around here do share that. You know, we talk about it every session, and I think it's, whether this bill is able to progress or not this year, I think it's worth having the conversation just so people can hear about it again and just understand that that's going on. So thank you for bringing this.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. I couldn't agree with you more. I think that would be a good bill, perhaps, to repeal the tax, provider tax. I think I'll introduce that if you don't mind. We have a question on Representative Gottwald and then Representative Huntley.
Well, Mr. Chairman and members, it's a very good question. About how the provider tax is or isn't working for us and providing the kind of support for people in need that we need here in the state of Minnesota. But to assume that it's simply going to be replaced by something wonderful called the ACA that isn't going to cost us anything or have any collateral impacts, I think is a bit presumptuous. I do look forward to the discussion, but there are numerous collateral impacts, unintended consequences, and so forth we can talk about in any one of these changes. And I would caution us that the approach that's coming down from Washington may not be what we want in the end.
Representative Hundley?
Well, I won't comment on that one, but Mr. Chair, you know, earlier today we talked about MRC cuts. That's the money that goes to fund primarily residency programs. Mayo gets, I think, nothing from that. And they are one of the largest residency systems in the state. Then we talked about the effect of what we were doing with the surcharge on Preferred One, putting them at a 4% disadvantage with their competitors. So we have to be very careful when we do things like this to make sure that we're not disadvantaging certain groups and advantaging other ones. And I think this particular bill is a way to partially address Mail's problem. It does not address all the inconsistencies that we put in place, but I think this is a good start. It does put a $4 million hole in per year, I think, in the healthcare access fund, and we're going to have to figure out how to deal with that.
Well, thank you, Representative Huntley. Then you bring up a very interesting point regarding the Merck funds, since you stated that the Mayo Clinic is one of our biggest area of residency training. It elevates the whole medical profession, and I think we all benefit from that. So I think that's a lesson that we can learn in this committee, that the Mayo can do it without any taxpayers' funds. With that said, I'll turn it over to Representative Avery.
And I'll put that one.
Mr. Chair, to set the record straight, we do get about $2.5 million with the revised formula.
Oh.
Representative Huntley.
There you go. Anyway.
I thought I was on top of that argument. Representative Abler?
It's just kind of fun to have a little restful time in the committee. We have to race through a two-minute testimony and have a little bit of light time. Representative Huntley mentioned the hole, and Representative Hosh was asking. I think I figured out how this not being in our target thing works. I think $4 million falls out of the sky and is put in a line item as being an in lieu of our problem, and so the deficit becomes the same as it would have been. And so there'll be a target of general fund money that would be awarded to the tax committee that they will then spend on their various programming and changes. I think that's how it works. So then that's my lobbying effort. I don't want to have to find $4 million of changes in my budget and our budget to have to offset that. So that's just, I think, just for what I know of it. So I just think about that.
Then, Mr. Chair, I think we should refer every bill to the tax committee.
Representative Hosh? Well, if there's no other questions for the testifier, Representative Quam, would you have any closing remarks regarding House File 113? I'm terribly sorry. I need to ask if there's any other testimony in the audience, either for or against the bill. If not, Representative Quam, would you like to close your remarks?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for your time, your input. And if you have suggestions of improving the language or improving the this bill, please let me know. We'll have those conversations and see how things progress in the other committees. But I do appreciate if you could support this, because I think it's a small step in showing that we are open to improving the business climate and making Minnesota a place that you can do medical business in.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Quam, for your good work on this. And Ms. Meyerly, thank you for your testimony. At this time, Representative Huntley renews his motion, as amended, to refer this to the Tax Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion carries. And if there's no other business in front of this body, we are adjourned. Wait, time out. Wait, reset. I didn't gavel. Irish eyes are smiling over there. Representative Murphy.
Thank you to the leprechaun in the room.
I resemble that compliment.
So, Mr. Chair,
mm-hmm. Yes.
I was just asking about I had a follow-up question to Representative Abler's roadmap that he laid out for us. So I know we talked about the omnibus bill coming out, I think, on the 22nd, and then we'll have through the 24th, right, to review it and get amendments prepared, et cetera, and then it goes off to Ways and Means. But the one thing I'm wondering about, we've heard, I think, four bills in committee that have been laid over for possible inclusion on our long-term care day. One of those, we heard them all, laid them over. I'm curious in the next few weeks if you're anticipating that we're going to be hearing more bills that will become the subject of the omnibus bill, and I'm just looking at the calendar, and I know there's an ambitious timeline, but I'm worried that the bulk of the omnibus bill is going to be stuff that we haven't really seen before, right? That it's just going to be the bill, it won't be the bills that we've heard and processed through, So it'll just be, you know, a chunk of new information, and then we just have a couple of days to review it. So I'm just wondering if you could give me a little advice, please.
Representative Abler?
Good question, and appropriate. We're going to try to get as much put in front of you beforehand as we can. I didn't set the ambitious schedule, and I think it's smart to get the topic out there. And I'm balancing your concerns with trying to do something different than a ray of just chop this, chop that. The parts you're going to see that are probably novel for this year are not novel in terms of me trying to go after some of the high utilizing elements across the system. And I think it'd be appropriate. We're trying to get language for all this stuff. It's, you know, I've been working hard at this and trying to make it as good as it can be. I'm not looking for your sympathy, but it's just the logistics of this become quite interesting. And so to the extent we can, we're getting things drafted. We met 6 hours this week. That's where yesterday was. And the day before that, to get some language. And I don't think there's any real secrets what we're doing, just that it's a matter of logistics and getting language out. But we're going to try to make some big hunk of language and put it into a bill leave it out there for the public to look at. We could have a perfect, actually right now the bill would be, those four bills would be pretty short omnibus, so it wouldn't take much time. Wouldn't quite do the savings we had in mind. We're going to make it as good as it can be. The trying to get away from the alternative of simply doing a bigger version of what we saw in the proposal we've been listening to. That's my goal, and I might rely on some of those, but hopefully on not as many as would have to be.
Representative Murphy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and my question is not about anything other than to try and understand. Yeah. We have been through this before. We know that it takes a lot of time to put together any piece of legislation, and a big piece of legislation that we're going to see takes a lot of time, and I understand that you're working hard. So my question is not about that, but I just want to make sure I understand for my work, for the constituents I represent, and for the people who come and listen, that we have a good understanding of you know, what's coming before us, so that we can consider it, give it our feedback, et cetera.
Yeah. So. And just I'll elaborate. I'm not trying to hide from the topic either. I think this is a good dialogue. We're going to make as much of the language available as can be made available. Every omnibus I've sat through, 13 of them, there's 12 so far, now 13th being this one, has had stuff that we've never seen anywhere before. It's a bipartisan phenomenon that occurs. And I know that if there's something that you want to amend about it, and you may, or just talk about it or amend it or whatever, there's a practicality about reading the thing when it's finally put on your desk, maybe Tuesday morning that day, and we get together at 12:30 and start talking about it and generating an idea and getting it drafted. We try to do the 24-hour thing. We've had hardly any bills that even are related to that. But if you have an idea to a staff in a reasonable proximity to that time, that's what I'm going to be trying to shoot for, just so that we'll have some idea of how many are going to be there, and that's the best I can say. And it's meant to be as open a dialogue as it can be. It could be a long day on Thursday, it could be a short day on Thursday. Maybe you'll really like it.
Thank you.
That's all right. Thanks.
Representative Franzen?
Why, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, and to Mr. Abler there, Representative Abler, I agree there with with Representative Murphy, because I don't want to have to find out what's in the bill by passing it and then saying, hey, oh, guess what? So I share her sentiments.
Safe to say you should read the bill before you pass the bill. If that, with that, we are adjourned.
Look forward to that.